Our reading tonight comes from Psalm 121, and you'll find that on page 616 of the Bibles in your pews. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you safe from all harm, and he will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and evermore.
Thanks, Ollie. Let's pray before we get into it. Lord, we thank you for your word. We ask that you would speak to us. Speak to our hearts tonight, for Jesus' sake. Amen. The experts have labels for all sorts of fears. We've got fear of the dark, scotophobia. There's sociophobia, it's fear of social situations. We all know of claustrophobia, fear of confined spaces, but there's also agoraphobia, a fear of open spaces. There's the fear of what I'm doing right now, public speaking, 3 or 4 people, evidently. But there's also fear of what you're doing right now, being seated. There's not only that, there's the fear of standing. There's the fear, and there's names for all these. And there's the fear of objects on the left side of the body, fear of objects on the right side of the body, the fear of hairy people, the fear of bald people, the fear of the color purple, and even the fear of being afraid, phobophobia. So while it's not hard to see the humor in much of this, evidently real people suffer from each of these. And the reality is all of us face different fears. The result is that these fears can often hold us back from living life to the fullest. Surveys say that 10 to 20% of people are afraid of going to the dentist. And so they don't go to the dentist. Fear holds them back from getting their teeth clean. It's not hard, really, then, to see how our fears can hold us back from experiencing God's best for us. You might be here tonight and be anxious or fearful about something coming up this next week. Maybe it's handling a certain relational conflict, a difficult financial situation, or work or uni situation. Maybe some are anxious about a particular health problem you're facing. And maybe even for you, it's the dentist coming up this week. It's assumed in verse 1 of Psalm 121 here that the psalmist has things to be afraid of. And so the question is asked that stands over the whole psalm. Where does my help come from? So this psalm, we're going to see, encourages us to do 2 simple things when our fear threatens to immobilize us or hold us back. Number 1, to be humble enough to seek help. And number 2, to recognize that the Lord is our only real helper. Look back at verse 1. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. So in lifting up his eyes to the mountains, the psalmist is probably daunted by the scary landscape ahead of him. He's apparently on or just about to depart on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Notice the superscription right above verse 1 there, that song of ascents. Now, this directs us to read this psalm as part of a larger collection of 15 psalms from 120 to 134. Each have the same superscription. According to most scholars, these would have been sung by Israelite pilgrims on their way up to Jerusalem to worship the Lord on Mount Zion. In the first of these, just back up to Psalm 120 there, evidently the psalmist is struggling with life when everyone around him seems to be stirring up trouble. Look at verse 6. Too long have I lived among those who hate peace. So the psalmist badly needs a break from it all. Today we sometimes say, I just need a holiday. Well, the godly Israelite said, I just need a holy day. And if we read these psalms together, well, when we get to the next psalm, Psalm 122, he's made it. He's made it to Jerusalem. Look there in verse 2 of the next psalm. Our feet are standing in your gates, O Jerusalem. So we might say he's on the ultimate holy day getaway. It's festival time. This is Fiji times 1,000. It's the one place God dwells in his temple, and all is right with the world. But before he actually gets to Jerusalem, he's got a long, arduous journey in front of him. So Psalm 121 is especially for pilgrims setting out on this journey. And as he lifts his eyes towards the mountains, towards Zion, really, he only sees lots of mountains out there. And these are mountains that are full of danger, full of wild animals, full of hideouts for bad guys. And you recall the parable of the Good Samaritan. And what road the Samaritan was on? He was coming from Jericho to Jerusalem. So up through the Judean desert and through the mountainous territory there. And do you remember what happened on that road? Why the Samaritan became famous? Because there was a Jewish guy that was attacked and left half dead. So if the mountains surrounding Jerusalem, as he looks up, lifts his eyes, the Lord dwells there, if they're in any way a sign of hope or symbols of hope for him, it seems clear that it's fear that strikes first. We can imagine as he considers departing towards these mountains that his mind is taken with anxiety. His stomach is churning, his heart maybe beating faster and louder. So he's got a choice to make. Will he let his fear hold him back? Will he give up on the holy day he so longs to have? Or will he seek help? Where does my help come from? Let's just consider this choice for a minute. How often are we filled with fear and anxiety about our way forward, and we allow fear to have the final word? Perhaps we're too prideful to ask for help. So we shrink back. We don't go out and talk to that stranger. We don't have that difficult situation, that difficult conversation that we know we need to have. We move away from rather than towards opportunities to minister to other people. Fear holds us back from the path ahead that God would have for us. So point number one, like the psalmist, when you're confronted with fear and anxiety, and when I'm confronted with fears and anxieties, we need to be humble enough to ask for help. But verse 2 makes it clear it's not enough to ask for help just from anyone or from anything. We need to be quick to recognize where our only true source of help lies. My help comes from the Lord. You almost can't lift your eyes towards the mountain peaks in Israel and not think of the idolatrous worship sites that dotted the tops of so many of those mountains. So the psalmist is saying that his help comes from the Lord. He may well be saying it's from the Lord, not from the other gods. In this case, then, he's passing over the most popular answer to his question that his unbelieving culture would be so ready to give him. So if he would have typed help on dangerous journey into Google, well, the first 100 listings would not even mention the name of the Lord. All the experts, all the WikiHow sites were saying, it's the gods of the land that are your best source of help. Turn to them. Of course, our own culture has its own gods, its own solutions to the fears and anxieties we have. We've got libraries full of advice and self-help books. We've got social media that allows us to have relationships without the fearful prospect of letting people know the real us. We've got endless sources of entertainment. Just a touch of the button, swipe of the finger, entertainment with the power to distract us from thinking too hard about our problems and our fears. Our psalmist here is a model of barely giving any consideration at all to all these other possible options. It's almost as if as soon as fear sets in, verse 1, he starts looking for help. And then he recalls, verse 2, where the true source of his help lies. My help comes from the Lord. But that's not quite enough. Notice he adds, the Lord, maker of heaven and earth. Now, why add that little bit? The American preacher Tony Evans tells a story of being stuck in an elevator. And as the elevator got stuck between the floors, people around him started yelling for help. And no answer. And so they're yelling, help, get us out of here. And this is in the days before mobile phones. At that moment, Evans turns around and grabs the phone of the elevator and calls security. Problem solved. He knew exactly the right place to turn to, and that made all the difference. To say that the Lord is maker of heaven and earth is to recognize he is exactly the right person to turn to. As the all-powerful maker of heaven and earth and everything in between, whatever I fear cannot possibly be bigger than he is. The mountains are full of danger. They are scary, but this God made the mountains and controls them. Not just the mountains, but everything in those mountains, every possible source of fear in them. Anyone play with the toy soldiers when you were growing up? Growing up in America, I played with cowboy and Indians, little plastic cowboys and Indians, and we set them up, and we get my rubber bands out and shoot them down. And I can still recall how fierce some of the Indians would be with their tomahawks in their arms and deep scars in the side of their faces. But all it took was for my baby sister to just crawl over the top of the whole thing and knock them all down. For God, any would-be fearsome attackers, they're like just plastic toy soldiers, cowboys and Indians to him. A quick flick, and they're tossed to the side. So the bottom line is, the Lord is the only one who can really be trusted to help. If you're going to yell for help, and you should, because the mountains are scary. And in reality, you are not equipped to handle what's in them. If you're going to yell for help, then cry out to the only one who can really help. Anyone remember the story of Hezekiah in Jerusalem? 701 BC, the largest army in the world surrounding the city and the mother of all vice grips. And Hezekiah cries out to the Lord as the maker of heaven and earth. Go read the story, Isaiah 37. The Lord proceeds to strike down 120,000 soldiers like so many plastic toys. This is our God. But there's an irony here then, because the psalmist is a believer in this God. He's on a journey to worship this God on Mount Zion in Jerusalem, this God who reigns above all, yet he's worried about where his help's going to come from to get there. Does that sound at all familiar? Like the psalmist, we too are on a journey toward Zion, toward the heavenly Zion. Yet the reality is that seldom is a correct vision of who our God really is, seldom is that in the forefront of our minds. And so our hearts become anxious. Like the psalmist, we need to remind ourselves of who exactly it is that we worship. He is the all-powerful creator of heaven and earth. And when we recall this, it should be like those people in the elevator realizing, oh, there's a security phone right there. That's our real source of help. If we don't recall this, fears can easily overwhelm us. Fears as insignificant as plastic toy soldiers, cowboys, and Indians can easily turn us away from God's best for us. So, number one, when we're tempted to let fear have the final word, we need to be humble enough to seek help. Number two, we need to recognize that the Lord is our only real helper. And the rest of the psalm really just expands on this picture of how a great and amazing a God that we have. What an amazing helper he is. Look at verse 3. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. When I think of slipping, he will not let your foot slip. I think of the long, icy winters growing up in Midwest America. The worst was what they call black ice. And that's ice so thin you cannot possibly see it. It's on the footpath or on the street. And you're walking along, and bam, before you even know you're falling, your backside slams down on the concrete. I had a friend in uni who actually fell face forward, and I still remember it took several months before he lost what looked like this funky appendage sticking out the side of his head. Slipping by definition, happens lightning fast. For God to stop it means that he's got to be right there guarding you every step of the way. When little kids are just getting the hang of walking, there's times when it's really dangerous for them to fall, like crossing a busy street. So you hold their hand, don't you? And you know the entire time across the street, they're probably going to trip up. But when they do trip, well, you're going to be right there holding them to get across to the other side together. So while the NIV here reads, he who watches over you is an okay translation, gets the idea in general, but it could be taken to imply God is kind of watching over from a distance. So you might have an ESV or another translation that has he who keeps you. I kind of like that better. This term often means to protect, to watch over very closely. It's a term used for professional guards, people whose sole job it is to watch someone very closely and make sure nothing bad happens. It's almost like one of God's primary jobs is to look after us. The word, and I like to call it, to translate it, keeper, guardian, to kind of capture all these ideas. It occurs 6 times in the psalm, so it's the key word, it's the dominant image here. It answers the question, you might say, of verse 1, well, just what kind of help does God offer? And the answer, throughout the most difficult terrain ahead, your keeper guardian is going to be right there by your side, holding your hand every step of the way. So how obvious could it be that he is our only real helper? And to drive the point home further in the second half of verse 3 there, he who keeps you will not slumber. Then again, we'll neither slumber nor sleep. We all know from TV and the movies that the number one risk for any security guard is that he's going to fall asleep right at that critical moment, right? Our family lives on the campus of SMBC, where I teach, and we used to live next door to some students as part of a semi, and one night, a robber broke in the back door, and the back door opened up onto the family room, where it just so happened that the male student, the husband, was sleeping in front of the door in the family room. They just had a new baby. So the thief is coming in, and what? He stopped right in his tracks, right? Well, no. All the thief had to do was step over the husband and then proceed to walk down the hall into his wife's room where his new baby was, grab her purse from the side of her bed, and proceeded to walk out the front door. In contrast to not being awake at the critical moment, Israel's guardian keeper will not sleep or slumber. He's 100% attentive, not just part of the time, but around the clock. We used to have a gate to keep our kids in our driveway to keep them from playing out on the busy street. And one day, my wife and I were in the house, and the kids are playing out there in the driveway, so they're gated in, but the ball goes through the gate and out into the street. And my wife and I were just talking inside, and Heather says, "Hey, I think I heard, is that the gate?" "Oh, no, don't worry about that. It's fine." Well, she goes out, and sure enough, my five-year-old figured out how to pick the lock or whatever. And there's my five-year-old, my three-year-old, and my one-year-old all right out there on the edge of the street. As parents, it's literally impossible to be keeper guardians of your kids at every moment. But the psalmist here says that's exactly what God does for us as his children. That's almost his job. That's what he's in the business of doing. You know, verse 4, "Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither sleep nor slumber." The focus there, behold is another word for indeed. It's look. The spotlight is put on God as the keeper of Israel. Century after century, God has proved himself faithful to Israel, Israel's keeper guardian. But that could raise the question, yes, he's Israel's keeper guardian, but is he really going to be so focused on caring for me? And the rest of the psalm answers this with a barrage of second-person singular pronouns. You and your, again and again, 10 times in the psalm. The Lord is your keeper, your shade. He's at your right hand. So yes, he's keeper guardian of Israel as a whole, but he cares just as much about your individual worries and concerns. He is your only real source of help. Look at verse 5. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. Literally, it reads that the sun will not strike you down. So the level of danger here is ramped up from verses 3 and 4. Here, the sun is pictured as a robber that's trying to strike down the pilgrimage. The pilgrim. I had a chance to do a dig, an archaeological dig in Jordan a number of years ago, and the sun is so hot in Jordan, and the work is so hot under the sun that most of our day had to take place right before sunrise and right after. The midday meal was 9 a.m., if that tells you anything. But it evidently didn't tell me enough, because I thought I could just show up in shorts and a t-shirt. Once that sun came up over the horizon, it was so scorching hot. I remember it was beating down on my head so hard. I had no choice but to take my shirt off and wrap it around my head to protect myself. And so I realized why Arabs wear the keffiyeh at that moment. Taking a long road trip in this kind of heat without an air-conditioned McDonald's every few exits could easily bring people dehydration, maybe even heat stroke, from which you would never recover. So the rare sight of a shade tree was a godsend. Verse 5, the Lord is your shade on your right hand. So imagine a shade tree that's just going to follow you along the entire journey. The psalmist says, that's what God is like. He's a shade tree on your right hand, the side that a personal guard would stand on to protect you. So no matter how bad the heat might get, psalmist is saying, the Lord is going to be right there by your side to protect you the whole way. And what about the moon? Why is that a danger? That's raised a lot of speculation. Some think it has to do with people thinking it was a kind of attacking demon. We still have these words like moonstruck and lunacy that speak of the negative effects of the moon or the night. I think the idea is that the sun and moon are used together to speak of all the dangers of both day and night. So throughout your journey, the Lord will be right there with you to protect you from danger, no matter what it is and no matter when it strikes. Psalm 46:1 puts it like this. The Lord is an ever-present help in times of trouble. Clearly, he's our only real source of help, isn't he? So what are you fearing here tonight? Maybe something that feels like it's bearing down on you, like the hot desert sun. Will you trust the Lord, your only real helper? Will you trust him to be your shade? Or will you let your fear hold you back? The final two verses sum up the whole. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He'll watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. The point couldn't be made more strong or more all-encompassing. The Lord will be your keeper guardian at all times and at all places. Of course, this is a short psalm, only 8 verses. And so it doesn't say everything on this topic. A couple things should be noted. One is the psalm applies to God's faithful children primarily. We could look at a lot of other psalms in this book that insist that it's those who love God and who are committed to him that he keeps and he helps. Secondly, I don't think you have to be too much of a skeptic to ask, well, yes, but is God really always going to keep those who love him, as it says there in verse 7? Keep them from all harm? Well, elsewhere in the Psalms, it's precisely those who are experiencing harm that the Lord helps and keeps. It's the ones facing illness, the ones who have somehow come onto hard times, the fatherless, the widow, the refugees. So It's clearly wrong to take this psalm in isolation, as if it's some kind of simplistic promise. If we are just faithful Christians, then God is going to always make our lives easy. The call to be a faithful servant for the psalmist here in the Old Testament is just like the call to be a faithful servant, a faithful disciple of Jesus in the New Testament. It's a call to follow the path that goes through suffering. See, God's promise is not to keep us from the troubles of life, but rather to keep us through the troubles of life. It's worth saying again. God's promise is not to keep us from the troubles of life, but to keep us through the troubles of life. We know that the book of Psalms was the prayer book of Jesus. And I can't help but think that Jesus would have prayed this very psalm as he set out for Jerusalem on his life's final pilgrimage to the festival of Passover. I lift up my eyes to the mountains, he would have said. And looking at the mountains standing between himself and Galilee and Jerusalem, well, I'm pretty sure Jesus, even Jesus, had at least the beginnings of some anxiety. But he would have been just like this psalmist. He would have had this deep-seated comfort, knowing that his final pilgrimage was going to result in being ushered in to the loving presence of his heavenly Father. Even for Jesus, God's help and close keeping, it didn't mean he bypassed the path of pain and suffering. The same goes for us. God's help and close keeping, it means that when the tough times do come, we can be confident. Our keeper guardian has not fallen asleep. He's right there protecting us and holding our hand. I want to end by everyone reciting the first two verses of the psalm. So I think they're so amazing. In fact, let's all just recite them together, and then I want you to find someone next to you, a partner, and you say it once to your partner, and the partner will say it back to you, verses 1 and 2, and then we'll conclude there. So read with me all together from verse 1. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. And now say it to a partner.